You know, as I was preparing the message for today, you know, I guess we could almost say that we're in the examination season leading up to Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread. It's still about 9 weeks away. It's interesting how, you know, God's plan starts. It doesn't start with the Feast of Tabernacles. It doesn't start with Day of Atonement or Trumpets. It doesn't start with Pentecost, Days of Unleavened Bread. I mean, it begins with Passover, but in some ways it really begins right now. The most important part of what progresses us through is what we're involved in now, really examining ourselves, looking inside. Had the opportunity, or wasn't necessarily opportunity, but experience with, you know, seeing people in the world and how they interact with other people this week in a couple of occasions. And, you know, people don't do what we do. They don't look inside. They don't reflect on how they treat people. And so this is a very important part, and this is not an examination message. I just want you to maybe think about the things we're going to talk about today in terms of what we're a part of and what we're doing. But, I mean, I guess you could say every message technically is an examination message. I guess they all are in some ways. Begin by reading just a couple of quotes. You know, success, this was by Winston Churchill. He said, success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts. Another quote, one more. Walter Elliott stated this. He said, perseverance is not a long race. It is many short races, one after the other. It's kind of an interesting perspective there. You know, we know this is God's people, that we have to keep moving forward. We have to keep advancing, not giving up, persevering, overcoming. And these quotes somewhat remind me of what Paul told Timothy, you know, late in his life in 2 Timothy 4, verses 6 through 8. And you could turn there if you'd like. 2 Timothy 4, and verses 6 through 8. You know, Paul here speaking to Timothy. And he stated this. He said, for I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. He knew he was approaching the end of his life. He said, I fought the good fight. I finished the race, and I've kept the faith. And finally, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day. Interesting how Paul states that. Interesting how he states that he was confident in the outcome. He said he will give me that on that day. I think a lot of that has to do with what we're going to talk about today concerning practice and perseverance in the future. But he goes on to say, he says, not only to me, but also to those who have loved his appearing. So it wasn't just for Paul, it was for those that love his appearing. That means us. This wasn't meant for Paul alone to have this ending or to have this confidence. So we could say that being confident in what we practice, again, part of what the season we're in, we're practicing these things, we practice them every year. What we practice, being confident in God's promises, and having determination to finish. You know, these things are very important to a Christian life. They're needed in order to cast our vision towards the future and continue running our race. Again, that's what's needed for life as a Christian. But what is also worth our consideration is a different quote. It's one a little bit in contrast to the ones we've already read. It's in contrast or opposition to the first. This one was by a man named Abraham Miller. Abraham Miller stated this. He said, a man begins to die when he ceases to expect anything from tomorrow. So a man begins to die when he ceases to expect anything from tomorrow. Now that would be a lack of confidence, at least in some things. You know, why would this be so important maybe to consider? You know, everywhere we see it everywhere, we think about Satan's influence in the world that we live in. We see it everywhere. We see it locally, we see it nationally. We see it in the news, TV shows that we have that are made available to watch. We hear it in music, technology, politics, you know, what's going on in the political realm. We see it in relationships. We see Satan's influence in families. We see his influence in freedoms and rights and all different ways that he's imprinted himself on this world. He's certainly given us a world in which our tomorrows are at least a little bit filled with uncertainty, not always certain of. And if he's successful with his plan of discouragement, if he's successful in changing the way we see our tomorrows, then he not only destroys our confidence, or could destroy our confidence and determination, but he could also begin to destroy something else that's incredibly vital to human life, to Christian life, and that is hope. That is hope. So what is hope? You know, how do we define it? How do we, you know, do we have it? What does it look like? You know, those are a few questions we're going to attempt maybe to uncover just a little bit today. I came across a couple of articles that I believe do a pretty good job of describing hope, at least what it meant to these writers that had an article and one wrote a book. This one by Melissa Eisler, and she stated this. She said, in a world full of fear, stress, and sadness, it can be difficult to maintain an optimistic view. She said, there seems to be more pain than you can heal, more dissent than you can mediate, and more uncertainty than you can make sense of. She says, the difference between those who let their circumstances bring them down and those who choose to embrace the goodness of life and find that comfort lies in the important element of hope. You know, hope is a powerful anecdote of feelings, or a powerful anecdote to feelings of despair and desolation. You know, a life marked by hope is a life marked by optimism. Regardless of where you find yourself, it doesn't mean that you're always happy. It doesn't mean that you can't feel emotions like hurt or sadness. But it does mean that you view your circumstances and those of the world around you goes beyond what's actually happening in the now. It says when you hold on to hope, you begin to understand that you are part of a greater narrative. Simply put, hope brings perspective. It can sustain you during the hard times and bring you even more fulfillment during the good times. She said, while hope acts as the perpetual light in the midst of darkness, though, she does say this, it's not easily cultivated. You know, we think about the world that we live in. We think about things and experiences that we have. We understand that hope is not always easy to cultivate. And we could say that Satan's plan and design certainly would be to eliminate hope, you know, thus remove confidence that we may have or not, or, you know, we should have, an ambition, motivation to persevere. I also came across another article, or actually this was a couple of excerpts from a book. The title of the book was The Power of Hope. It was written by psychologist Susan B. Phillips. And she had this to say on the topic, and she defined hope this way. You know, she said, hope is broadly defined as an emotional state that promotes the belief in a positive outcome. And she went on to say, clearly we need hope. But even as we embrace it, you know, even as we embrace hope, we often wonder, does hope really make a difference? Is it a myth? Is it fiction? Is it collective denial? You know, hope, can I really have hope? Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's hard. But no matter our thoughts there, she goes on to say, in my clinical experience with people over the years, hope seems to be an important ingredient in the equation of life to simply keep moving. Perseverance. And maybe one final example of hope written by a gentleman by Emil Brunner. And he states it this way. He said, what oxygen is for the lungs, such is hope for the meaning of life. And as the human organism is dependent on its supply of oxygen, so is humanity dependent upon its supply of hope. So from man's perspective, you know, hope sounds pretty important. Pretty important. So what does God say about hope? In Hebrews 11 and verse 1, if you'd like to turn there, I believe it's probably a memory scripture for most everyone here. Hebrews 11 and verse 1 really puts hope in perspective, at least from God's point of view. Hebrews 11 verse 1 states, now faith is the substance of things hoped and the evidence of things not seen. English Standard Version states it a little bit differently. It says states it as faith is the assurance. You know, faith is the assurance of things hoped for. You think about Paul was certain in what he hoped for. He had confidence in his reward. You know, the very substance of our faith is found in our hope. And without hope, how can we truly have faith? How can we truly have faith? That's what God's telling us. And we could ask here, how could Noah or Abraham or Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Rahab, Gideon, Barak, all those men and women of faith that we read about, and so many more listed, unnamed people referenced, you know, how could they have possibly, you know, how could they have overcome the world and the events of their time, events of each of their own personal circumstances? You know, how could they do that without hope? How could they have done those things and overcome their own apprehension at times? And yes, even their own fears. How could they have overcome their own fears without hope? And yes, fear does enter into the hope equation. It does enter into that. One gentleman put it, I can't pronounce his name, but he said, there is no hope unmingled with fear. And there's no fear unmingled with hope. But he goes on to say, hope is being able to see that there is light despite the darkness. Light despite the darkness. And we must be able to cultivate hope, even in the darkest times. And again, something very difficult at times to do. And we have a reference, to these kind of times in Scriptures. I would say that it's one of the first understandings that we gain as Christians, as part of the hope that we learn through Scripture, the one we're about to read. And it's something that we acknowledge or we have knowledge of. We could say it's the basis for all of our hope, and it's found in 1 Thessalonians 4. And you could turn there if you'd like. 1 Thessalonians 4. I'm going to be reading verses 13 through 18. I'm grabbing the one on the right. Mr. Barbeau, did you grab the one on the either side? So 1 Thessalonians 4, again, the basis, one of the foundational basis for our hope, 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 13 through 18. And Paul writes this, he says, brothers and sisters, we do not want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Christ those who have fallen asleep in Him. According to the Lord's word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those that have fallen asleep. For the Lord Himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of an archangel, and the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. And after that, we who are alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will be with the Lord forever. He goes on to say, verse 18, therefore encourage one another with these words. You know, we're told to encourage one another with these words because it is our hope, the resurrection. The resurrection and the change to spirit beings of the first fruits, those who remain faithful, we have that to hold on to. That is our hope. The hope that we have, that God will bring to life, you know, friends and family, you know, all that have ever lived, those that didn't have God's truth, you know, bring them to life as well. This is our foundational Christian hope based on God's plan that He's revealed to us, which again, we're in the beginning stages of the beginning of His plan when we're in the examination phase of our life. But having said all these things concerning hope thus far, you know, there is an aspect of hope that must be fully understood to round out the true picture. It's not just what we've stated up to this point. And this will be the thrust, really, of the remainder of the message. We've mentioned a lot so far, at least about hope, our need for it, you know, what it can do for a person, you know, what is our hope in. But this definition of hope marks an aspect that cannot be overlooked, and it's found in the definition of the word. You know, Webster's dictionary states it this way. It said, hope means this, to desire with expectation of obtainment or fulfillment. I'll repeat, hope means this, to desire with expectation of obtainment or fulfillment. Or we could say here, hope is to expect with confidence. Hope is to expect with confidence. If I have hope in something, then I must be confident that I can attain it or that I can do it. If not, it's not really hope. And where did we just hear this? What did we just read from in Paul in 1 Thessalonians? He says, I fought the good fight, I finished the race, I've kept the faith. How did he have faith? Because of hope. And he says, there's laid up for me a crown of righteousness which the Lord will give me on that day. He had hope in something that he knew he would achieve. He knew how he had lived his life. He knew that he had taken God's word seriously, God's plan seriously, and therefore he had a hope in what will happen. It was hope in what he could attain. So hope isn't something far-fetched. It isn't something unrealistic. Hope isn't found in the things that are unattainable. That would simply be want. You know, I want something to happen. But hope is not that way. My hope, our hope, is based upon what we practice, thus giving us confidence in the outcome of what is to come. That's what our hope is based upon. It's what we know we can attain and can be attained. I want to turn our attention here just a moment, or really for a good part of the rest of the message, to a story. And I've referenced this before. And I believe there's elements in what we're going to talk about today, elements of how our practice makes a difference, you know, how hope makes a difference, and how having confidence makes a difference. But they're all kind of joined. You know, there's not really one without the other. We don't have hope, you know, without having practiced things, without having knowing what we can achieve and what we can do. We always need help, but I think this story kind of really bears some of that out. You know, this is a Bible account. It's found in 1 Samuel 17. We will not be reading through those scriptures. I'm going to kind of narrate it a little bit. It's a story of David and Goliath. Most of you know the story quite well. I want to share it as far as narrate it from a kind of a paraphrasing point of view, but then I want to offer some details to kind of shed some light on the things concerning that story, primarily the story and the account, again, itself. But maybe just a quick summary. And you can go back and read the scriptures yourself, 1 Samuel 17. But maybe a quick summary to get our minds focused on this particular account in the Bible. So here we have the Philistines. They're set to do battle against Saul and the Israelite army. And through a myriad of events, we now have this boy named David. Now he's set to battle with this giant, this man named Goliath. Now David, he's a shepherd with a sling. And Goliath is this huge warrior decked out in heavy armor and weaponry. And as we know, the story ends with David slaying the giant with a sling and thus ending the threat of battle for King Saul and the Israelites. And that kind of sets our mind kind of on the overview of the story. There's a gentleman by the name of Malcolm Gladwell, not in the church, but he gave some insight into the region, and I thought it was an interesting narration of kind of the way things, the setting, and I think it kind of plays a little bit into the story. So I'm going to use part of what he wrote to kind of, again, continue to narrate this. Now, this account that took place roughly 3,000 years ago, it takes place in a region known as the Shephelah, which is now Israel. And there's a mountain range on the eastern border where we find Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Hebron. And on the western border is an area called the Coastal Plain, which is the location of where Tel Aviv is today. And connecting the mountain ranges of the east with the coastal plains to the west is this area called the Shephelah. And the Shephelah is a series of valleys and ridges that run east to west. And you must go through the Shephelah to get from the coastal plain into the mountains. And it's currently today filled with forest and wheat fields and the like. And in the history of the region, the Shephelah has performed a specific function. It is the means by which the armies of the coastal plain get up into the mountains to threaten those who live there. And 3,000 years ago, that's exactly what was happening in this account. The Philistines were living in the coastal plains, mostly probably from Crete. And so the Philistines, they want to make their way down from the coastal plain to attack Israel. And King Saul gets wind of this. Again, we're kind of paraphrasing a little bit. So he and his army come down from the mountain to meet and stop the Philistines and confront them in the valley of Elim. And the Israelites dig in along the northern ridge, and the Philistines dig in along the southern ridge. And of course, they're there for weeks, as we know, in kind of a standoff. And to attack the other, an army would have to go down into the valley and up the other side, and in doing so, would be completely left exposed, and neither army desired to do this. So to finally break the deadlock, the Philistines send their mightiest warrior down to the valley floor. And he calls out to the Israelites. He says, "Send down your mightiest warrior, and we'll have it out, you know, just the two of us." And now this was a tradition, you know, this type of one-on-one combat. This was a tradition called single combat. It was a way of settling disputes without incurring bloodshed of a major battle. And the Philistines, as we know, they would send down their greatest warrior, who was a giant in stature. You know, he's somewhere between 7 and 8 feet tall, if we read the account, outfitted head to toe in bronze armor. He has a sword, a javelin, and a spear, and more than likely he's really terrifying if you were to see him. And finally, the only person who will come forward is this shepherd boy named David. He eventually goes up to King Saul and he says, you know, I'll fight him. And it took a little convincing, but Saul probably really didn't have a lot of other choices. There was no one else really coming forth. And he turns to David and he says, okay, but you got to wear this armor. Because you can't go down there without armor. So he gives it to David. David evaluates it and eventually says, you know, I can't wear this stuff. And we know that the Scripture says he's not proved that armor. So it wasn't something that he was willing to wear. In other words, again, he had never worn armor before. So he reaches down and collects his stones and he heads down to meet the giant. And Goliath sees this person approaching and says, come to me so I can feed your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the fields. So he issues this kind of taunt, if you will, towards David. And of course, David draws closer and closer. And as he approaches, the giant sees David is only carrying a staff. And he says to David, he says, am I a dog? Am I a dog? You're going to come at me with sticks? And David takes out one of his stones and puts it in his sling, rolls it around, and lets it fly. It hits Goliath right between the eyes and on his forehead, his only real vulnerable spot. Goliath falls down, either dead or unconscious at the time, and David goes over, takes Goliath's sword, cuts his head off. And the Philistines turn and see this, and they run. They leave. And that's kind of the basic account of the story of David and Goliath. But I'd like to maybe take a few minutes to maybe dig just a little bit deeper into that story. Just a little bit deeper. There's really, I think, a lot more when we think about the message today that we can glean from David and Goliath. So David in this story, aside from God being with him, which is no small thing, but aside from God being with him, is supposed to be an underdog. You know, you think about us in the world, I think Satan looks at us maybe sometimes and thinks we're an underdog. But David's supposed to be the underdog. In other words, in terms of David and Goliath, in other words, the term David and Goliath has entered into our language today as a metaphor for improbable victories. Anybody remember Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson? You know, Buster Douglas, Mike Tyson boxing match. Buster Douglas, certainly an underdog. That was an improbable victory. You know, we see it when the weak party wins over someone much stronger. In college basketball, you have that Cinderella story, this no-name team. You've got movie The Hoosiers, where this team comes out of nowhere and beats this other team. They had no chance, really no chance of beating. So David and Goliath has entered into the narrative that we use today. But we could ask here, but why do we call David an underdog? You know, why do we call him an underdog? Well, there's a few reasons why. He's a kid. That would be one reason. Maybe even small in stature at the time, and Goliath is this big, strong giant. Of course, Goliath is also an experienced warrior, and David's just this shepherd boy. Just a shepherd boy. But mainly because Goliath is this giant, maybe outfitted with all this glittering armor and a sword and a javelin and a spear, and all David has is a sling. All he's got is a sling. Of course, we know he's got God's backing. Not saying that, but physically speaking, he just has a sling. But referring to David as only having a sling, well, that's a mistake. That's a mistake. In ancient warfare, there were three kinds of warriors. There was cavalry, who rode on horseback and chariots. There were heavy infantry. Those were armed foot soldiers with swords and shields and some kind of armor. And then there were artillery, and those were archers. But more importantly, they were slingers. A slinger is someone with a leather pouch with two long cords attached to it. And they put a projectile, most likely a rock or maybe a lead ball, in the pouch. They whirl it around, they let one of the cords go, and the effect is to send the projectile towards its target. And that's what David has. But not a simple slingshot like the one I built when I was younger. This was in no way a child's toy. It was, in fact, a very devastating weapon. You know, when David was spinning his sling, it is said to be spinning at about 6 to 7 revolutions per second. And when the projectile is released, it is probably moving at a speed somewhere between 35 to 40 meters per second, substantially faster than a baseball being thrown by its fastest pitcher. And not only that, but if you were to do a ballistics test on the stopping power of a sling, it is roughly the same stopping power as a 45 caliber handgun. That's pretty good. A very, very dangerous weapon. And how about accuracy? Well, historical records indicate that experienced slingers, could maim and or kill a target up to 200 yards away. And from medieval tapestries, there is evidence to suggest that experienced slingers could hit birds in flight. Deadly accurate. So when David, an experienced slinger, winds up his sling to fire at Goliath, he has every intent to hit him precisely in the spot that he did, right between his eyes. And if we were to do a study on ancient warfare, time and time again, we would find that slingers were the decisive factor against heavy infantry battles. And Goliath is heavy infantry. And so you have this big, lumbering warrior. He's expecting David to come to him. He called out to him, "Come to me." And more than likely, he's expecting hand-to-hand combat. And that's probably what King Saul was expecting. Probably expecting him to do that as well, since he tried to give him that armor to wear. But David had no plans to fight Goliath that way. David had spent his whole life defending his flock, using and practicing with his sling. He had been practicing for this moment his whole life. And when we evaluate the story and the account this way, David doesn't appear necessarily to be the underdog. And his victory doesn't necessarily appear to be that improbable. And there are many lessons, I believe, and analogies to pull from this detailed account. But my purpose today in sharing this is, if David hoped to slay Goliath, if that was his hope, it was based upon what he knew that he could do. He wasn't just guessing. It wasn't guesswork. Hope is only true hope if it is realistic. If it is realistic. Hope is only real hope if it is attainable. You know, true hope in a thing, it is not blind hope. You know, there must be that expectation that said thing can happen and that I can be the one to do it. I can be the one to do it. And that is what David knew. You know, he wasn't guesswork. It wasn't luck. And in viewing this story this way, does it somehow diminish or take God out of the equation? Emphatically no. Certainly not. That's not what's being said at all. David's own words in 1 Samuel 17 and verse 45, he says, "You come to me with a," talking to Goliath, he said, "You come to me with a sword and a spear, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts." So in no way does it take God out of the picture. God was with him. You know, God had always been with him. You know, Scripture states, and examples show that time and time again, that God will always go before his people. You know, that's what we read in Deuteronomy 31 and verse 8. In Deuteronomy 31 and verse 8, you can take that, have that in your notes. "The Lord himself goes before you. He will be with you. He will never leave you, and he will never forsake you." That's what we know, that God is always there for us. You know, we never have to question that in our life. And that's of valuable importance, you know, in the world that we live in, that God is always with us. Did God go before David in this battle? Absolutely. Absolutely. But God had really gone before this battle and prepared David for this exact moment. He'd been with David all of his life. You know, he had practiced this. He had practiced this very moment as he was defending his flocks. You know, did God intervene that day? Well, he was certainly there with David. But God was in David's life long before this event. Long before this event. just like He had done with you and me. You know, He's always been in, He's been a part of our life. He's been a part of your life. You know, the miracle wasn't necessarily David defeating Goliath. The miracle was how God can change the course of a person's life. You know, that's the miracle. That's the hope. That's the faith that we have in what God can do in a person's life. That's the tools He gives us. You know, the practice, the things that we do, the foundational things that God places before us, you know, every single day with His holy day plan that we are to practice. And as we practice those things, that's what gives us the confidence and the hope that we can finish our race. That what is laid up and stored up for His people will, in fact, happen. And we get that through how we live our life, how we practice, again, the things that God puts before us. Again, He had always been with David. He made him ready for whatever battle that he would face next. Whatever he would face next, just like what He does for you and me. Philippians 1 and verse 6, you can just have that in your notes. He says, "Be confident of this, that He who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ's return." You know, God started a work in us, and as long as we don't interfere with that work, that will be completed. And again, they give us every tool that we need. Again, spelled out in His holy day plan, spelled out in messages every week that we hear, that we have to look and evaluate and determine what we apply to our life. And that's probably one of the most interesting things that in my experience, at least this week, is that how many, you know, people don't take a message and actually put it to work in their life. They don't look at it. And this doesn't have anything to do with anybody in the church. I'm just talking about people in general. But you can deliver, there are things staring them in the face, and they never internalize and look at how, you know, what do I need to do differently? You know, what do I need to change? What do I need to adopt that I'm not adopting? And the people in, a lot of the people in the world, they don't consider those things. And I know we do. We do. It's a special calling and opportunity that we have. Again, God tells us that He will finish the work that He began in us, and that means preparing us as well. And we, you and me, so we've mentioned several things today in the message, you know, our life, our circumstances that we have that come up at time. You know, maybe David, the point that he was at in his life. And of course, we have these checkpoints, I think, that occur that test our faith, test our hope, test our confidence. You know, how are we doing along the way? Maybe this was one of those progress test points for David. You know, this battle. You know, he probably didn't have to speak up. He probably didn't have to go fight Goliath, but he did. He was prepared, and so he did. So this might have been one of those test checkpoints for him. And all of us have these checkpoints time to time in our life that test maybe where we are. You know, where are we in the faith? Where are we with our hope? Where are we with our confidence? I mean, how many people in the room haven't had their confidence tested from time to time? I know I have. So, again, but he did step up. This is why it was recorded for us. You know, this example of his life was recorded for us so that we could read this and we could draw so many things from that. But because he was ready, because he was prepared, because he was willing, he was confident in what he practiced. And as mentioned in the message earlier, just as Paul was running his race and finishing his race, you know, again, he said, I've finished my race. I fought the good fight. And he knew that God had a crown laid up for him. And neither of the two of them, you know, neither Paul nor David, neither of the two of them, you know, had blind hope. You know, they weren't hoping in things they couldn't attain. Neither of them had hope of the impossible. And again, that's the point. Both had lived a life to that point that guaranteed that their hope would be a reality. David winning his battle, and of course, Paul finishing his race. So as we kind of begin to work our way to a close, as we begin to consider, again, our life and, you know, where we are in our walk and what we have left before us and roadblocks that are going to be along the way, things that are going to test our confidence. It's always good to come back to the foundational things that God gives us every single year that we practice. You know, just like David practiced, I know Paul practiced these things. You know, it starts with our examination here now, you know, as we lead up to Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread, looking for those things inside that, looking for circumstances that don't need to be there, environments that don't need to be there, that test us, that keep us from following through with what God has placed before us, that we know that we're to be doing. And if we use this time and we really use it well, and it's if we really use it well, you know, then we can be confident. You know, let us take these days and the time that we have leading into Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread. Let's be sure we take them very seriously. And let us practice this part of God's plan for us to be, for us so that we can have the hope, in other words, real hope and confidence in what God has prepared for His faithful.